We would like to send out a special thanks to Nutrafol for supporting The Trail Went Cold. It's time to join the thousands of women standing up for their strands. You can grow thicker, healthier hair by going to Nutrafol.com and entering the promo code COLD, and you'll get 20% off. That's Nutrafol.com and enter the promo code COLD to get 20% off. Thank you, and enjoy the episode. January 16th, 1985. Massillon, Ohio. 64-year-old Bill Wacker informs the local sheriff that his home has been ransacked, and this is the third time such an incident has happened. Months later, Bill's wife, Dorothy Wacker, is attacked inside the house by an unidentified man who had asked to use the phone after claiming his car broke down. Over the course of the next decade, the Wackers are subject to threatening notes and phone calls and other odd forms of harassment at their home from an unknown party. Even after Dorothy is physically attacked for a second time, the authorities cannot find any evidence which points to a specific suspect, and the motive for the harassment campaign is never determined. After that, the trail went cold.
Well, as far as all this harassment is going on, which to me it looks like it's trying to force us to move, why should I move? Why should we move? Why should we be forced out by a kook? To me, that's what it is a kook. I'll not do it. I'll stay there, protect our own.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to our final Halloween-themed episode of The Trail Went Cold. I'm your host, Robin Warder, and today we're finally going to be covering an infamous story which is truly out of the ordinary, the harassment of Bill and Dorothy Wacker. That sound clip you just heard was from an interview with Bill Wacker on Unsolved Mysteries, where he expressed his belief that both he and his wife were being targeted by a kook. As you probably know, every October, it's become a tradition for The Trail Went Cold to count down to Halloween by releasing episodes about creepy mysteries which have some sort of Halloween slant to them, and I thought this was an ideal time to finally cover one of our most heavily requested cases in the history of this podcast. The story involves an elderly married couple from Ohio named Bill and Dorothy Wacker, whom, starting in the mid-1980s, would find themselves at the center of a relentless harassment campaign which would pretty much last for a decade. Things escalated to the point where the story wound up receiving national exposure when it was featured on an episode of Unsolved Mysteries, but it's unclear when and if the harassment came to an end. Now, I'll state right up front that aside from the Unsolved Mysteries segment, there are virtually no other sources of information about this story available, which is the main reason I've held off uncovering it for so long. However, I should also mention that if you visit the Unsolved Mysteries message board at the Sitcoms Online forum, which I'm always referencing, you'll find that this case is the topic of the largest thread there, which began way back in 2004, and at the time of this recording, is currently 96 pages and 1,428 posts long. So obviously, this is a heavily discussed story, and since the source of the Wackers' harassment campaign was never identified, some people have speculated that the whole thing might have been an elaborate hoax, and the Wackers staged all the attacks on themselves. Well, later on in this episode, I'm also going to spend some time discussing a case I recently learned about at the Unresolved Mysteries subreddit involving an 87-year-old woman named Sigrid Barginde. Like the Wackers, Sigrid claimed she was being harassed in her home by an unknown attacker, but the key difference is that she eventually wound up dead under suspicious circumstances. While I do not believe the two cases are connected, there are some interesting parallels between them, and the motives for what happened remain unclear. Anyway, before we get started, just a quick reminder that The Trail Went Cold is a weekly podcast, which is currently available for download on several platforms, including Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, and Spotify. So if you like this podcast, be sure to subscribe to it, and please leave us a rating or review on any of those sites to help spread the word and garner us more exposure. The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so if you would like to learn how to support the show, please visit our page at patreon.com/thetrailwentcold. For as little as $1 a month, you can garner access to exclusive rewards, which may include stickers and thank you cards, early access to episodes, and bonus content. So with all that out of the way, let us now delve into the bizarre saga of the Whackers. Our story begins in 1985 in Massillon, Ohio, a town of just over 30,000 people located in Stark County. Our central figures are 64-year-old Bill Whacker and his 57-year-old wife, Dorothy Whacker, who live in a rural home located outside of town next to a two-lane highway. By this point, the Whackers have been married for 39 years and have two grown daughters, Kathy and Peggy. On January the 16th, Bill contacted the Stark County Sheriff's Office to inform them that he and Dorothy had returned home to discover that their house was ransacked. This marked the third time someone had broken into the Whacker residence and vandalized it, but the culprit was never identified, and another strange incident would occur in July of that year. At the time, Dorothy had recently undergone heart surgery and was at home recuperating when she heard a knock at the front door. Dorothy went to answer it, and said she was greeted by a blonde man in his mid-20s who told her that his car had broken down and he needed to use the phone to call for assistance. The breakdown had apparently occurred somewhere down the road, so even though Dorothy could not see this man's car, she agreed to invite him inside. While the man used the phone in the dining room, Dorothy entered the kitchen and could overhear his conversation in the background. Dorothy then heard the man hang up and thank her for the assistance, so she assumed he was leaving the house. But shortly thereafter, Dorothy claimed she was attacked from behind and knocked unconscious with blows to her head and jaw. When Dorothy woke up, she was now lying bound and gagged on the kitchen floor, but managed to crawl towards an open window and cry out for help. When some neighbors heard her, they ran over to the house and called for assistance. Dorothy received some medical treatment, and thankfully, she was not seriously injured. However, when Bill returned home, he discovered that a number of items had been stolen from the house, including a .22-caliber revolver, a movie camera, a radio scanner, and an antique watch. And most curiously, the words, "Cheaper, but will do," have been written on the dining room wall in crayon. Even though Dorothy provided a description of the young man who entered her home, and the police created a composite sketch for him, he was never caught or identified. But things took an even stranger turn 4 months after the attack, when Bill discovered his stolen .22-caliber revolver on the front porch. The gun was wrapped in a plastic shopping bag, and shortly thereafter, the other items which had been stolen, including the movie camera, radio scanner, and antique watch, would also be dropped off at the Whacker residence at different times. It was during this time period when Bill and Dorothy started receiving a series of bizarre, harassing phone calls. Sometimes, the Whackers only heard the sound of heavy breathing on the line, but on other occasions, an unidentified male caller would threaten violence against them. The Whackers attempted to counter this by changing their phone number multiple times, but the responsible party would somehow manage to always learn their new numbers and continue calling up the couple to harass them. In addition, Bill and Dorothy would frequently hear loud banging on the side of their house, and the incidents always took place after it got dark. But whenever they checked outside, they never saw or heard anyone, not even the sound of a car speeding away from the scene. Things reached the point where the Whackers decided to mount a security light outside the front of their house, but it wasn't long before they found a note on their porch which read, quote, "Sunday didn't do you in. next time, called but didn't answer, your lights are a laugh, end quote. More threatening notes would gradually be left on the Whackers' porch, which featured such messages as, quote, you scum, I'll get even, no junk, this time, ha ha, end quote. It's also worth mentioning that certain words like Sunday, lights, and this would be spelled with a Z instead of an S. Police suspected that someone had used their non-dominant hand to scrawl these notes out in an attempt to conceal their handwriting, and no fingerprints were ever found on any of them. The harassment would continue on for years, but there didn't seem to be any rhyme or reason or consistency to the whole thing. Sometimes, the Whackers would go months without any issues, but then they'd face a non-stop flurry of activity for about a month or so before things got quiet again. And every time the Whackers reported these incidents, the police were unable to turn up any suspects or evidence to suggest what the possible motive for this harassment might be. Well, things escalated on the evening of October the 27th, 1993, when Dorothy was attacked from behind outside a residence by an unknown party. She received some lacerations to her head and injuries to her skull and was taken to the hospital for treatment, but even though police performed a search of the area and questioned the Whackers' closest neighbors, they could not find any eyewitnesses who saw anything unusual. This prompted Stark County Sheriff W. Bruce Umpleby to propose the idea to Dorothy that it might have been her own husband who attacked her, and perhaps Bill was responsible for staging a lot of the harassment the couple had received. However, Dorothy completely discounted this theory, and no evidence was ever found to support it. A few weeks after the attack, the Whackers decided to stake out their own house after it got dark in hopes of finally catching the perpetrator in the act. While Dorothy and her daughter Kathy remained indoors, Bill hid inside a trailer parked in the driveway, and the couple's two sons-in-law, Dan and Clay, would watch the residence from inside a van parked across the road. The group would communicate with each other on walkie-talkies, but after watching the house for nearly 4 hours, nothing happened, so they decided to end the stakeout at around 10:30 p.m. Well, almost immediately thereafter, Dorothy and Kathy heard thumping sounds on the front porch, and when Bill, Dan, and Clay ran to the house, they found a note which read, quote, get the message. However, no one from the family was able to catch a glimpse of the person who left the note, and it seemed like they had somehow found a blind spot to do this undetected. Anyway, the Whackers decided to take their story to Unsolved Mysteries, and it would be featured on an episode which aired on May the 25th, 1994. As far as I can tell, the segment did not lead to any answers about who was actually responsible for tormenting the Whackers, and it's unclear if the harassment came to an end after the show aired. What is known is that Bill passed away in July of 1999 at the age of 79, while Dorothy died 11 years later at the age of 83. However, the full truth about what actually happened to the Whackers continues to remain an unsolved mystery. So I guess you could say, the trail went cold. But before we continue, we would like to take a moment to express our thanks towards our new sponsor, Nutrafol, as we are very excited that they are supporting The Trail Went Cold. There are at least 30 million women out there who are impacted by weakened or thinning hair. But if you're among them, know that you're not alone, and there's a solution you can trust to deliver results. I mean, you don't want to have to use the phrase, the trail went cold, when describing your hair growth. That's why thousands of women have taken back control of their hair with Nutrafol. Many users have raised that the supplement not only transformed their hair, but restored their confidence too. Nutrafol offers two targeted formulas for women that are clinically shown to improve hair growth and thickness with less shedding through all stages of life. While healthier hair growth takes time, you will begin to experience thicker, stronger, faster-growing hair in 3 to 6 months. In fact, when a clinical study was performed, 86% of women reported improved hair growth after 6 months. More than 1,500 top doctors recommend Nutrafol as an effective and high-quality solution for healthier hair. I mean, I have at least one female friend who is a bit sensitive about her thinning hair, but she took the plunge and decided to try Nutrafol, and lo and behold, the hair growth greatly improved within months, and she now uses it all the time. You can grow thicker, healthier hair and support our show by going to Nutrafol.com and using our promo code, and new customers will get 20% off. This is their best offer available anywhere, plus free shipping on every order. Get 20% off at Nutrafol.com, spelling Nutrafol.com, and use the promo code COLD. That's Nutrafol.com, and the promo code is COLD. Thank you, and enjoy the rest of the episode. So like I mentioned in the intro, this most definitely ranks as one of the most bizarre and memorable stories ever featured on Unsolved Mysteries, so much so that the main discussion thread about this case at the aforementioned Unsolved Mysteries message board is currently 96 pages long. And that's quite remarkable when you consider there's a limited amount of information available, and the lone source is the original Unsolved Mysteries segment. However, I can definitely see why there's always been a fascination with stories about people who are relentlessly harassed for long periods of time. In today's digital age, it's pretty easy to harass someone behind the anonymity of a computer screen, but back in the 1980s and early 90s, harassment campaigns like this required a ton of effort, so being able to maintain them for years at a time is a scary level of devotion. Unsolved Mysteries featured a couple of other stories just like this one, which have previously been covered on episodes of The Trail Went Cold. There's the saga of Bashir Khushokchi, who was tormented for several years by thousands of threatening phone calls from an anonymous figure nicknamed L'Enfant, which is French for the child. There's the Circleville Letters case, in which multiple people received a series of threatening anonymous handwritten letters over the course of several years. And there's the story of Cindy James, who claimed she was being relentlessly harassed and violently attacked by an unidentified stalker for 6.5 years before she was found dead under suspicious circumstances. In each of these cases, there are theories about who might have been responsible for the harassment and their possible motives. There's zero doubt that the harassment in the Circleville and L'Enfant cases was legitimate because it was backed up by letters and phone records. But the Cindy James case is a lot more controversial. Even after extensive police surveillance, they could not find any evidence which pointed to a suspect, so the authorities began to believe that Cindy was suffering from some sort of mental illness, which caused her to stage all the attacks against herself before she ultimately staged a very elaborate suicide. Since Cindy wound up dead, we can at least pinpoint a moment when her harassment came to an end. But what's complicated about the Wacker case is that we don't know what happened after their story received national exposure on Unsolved Mysteries, only that Bill and Dorothy both died of old age years later. With Cindy James, the police and some of the journalists who have covered the case have openly expressed their belief that Cindy's attacks were self-inflicted and there was no foul play in her death. But the authorities' opinion about the Wacker case is a bit more ambiguous, because the only public comments were provided by Stark County Sheriff W. Bruce Umpleby during his Unsolved Mysteries interview. Umpleby did claim that after Dorothy was assaulted in October of 1993, he decided to ask her if she believed it was possible that Bill could have attacked her, but Dorothy unequivocally said no. However, at no other point has anyone from law enforcement ever publicly expressed their belief that the Wackers were staging all these attacks on themselves. Well, in spite of this, if you look up any online discussion about this case, that is a heavily debated topic, as some people do seem to believe that the Wackers may have orchestrated an elaborate hoax. If they didn't, then that thread at the Unsolved Mysteries message board would not be 96 pages long. The thread is legendary for a number of reasons, as during the past 16 years, it has even been infiltrated by a number of trolls, one of whom went by the username Akook. Most of these trolls' posts have since been deleted, but you can still see snippets from a couple of them, which have been quoted in posts from other users. I'm not going to repeat them here, but their comments are pure batshit insanity, so you get the sense that these trolls may have had some personal animosity towards Bill and Dorothy, and were possibly even involved in the harassment campaign against them. There are also a number of threads about this case at the Unresolved Mysteries subreddit, but only about 5 months before this episode was recorded, a thread was started by a poster under the username Soviet Baby, who said they were related to Bill Wacker because their great-grandmother was Bill's sister. Apparently, Soviet Baby did not even find out about this story until recently, and was not born yet when it originally took place. They claim they asked some of their surviving relatives about it, but didn't learn any new information, which is not already public knowledge, though it was interesting to hear that the attacks apparently pretty much just stopped, and no real motive was ever determined. The biggest problem I've always had with the hoax theory is that since there's so little information available about this case, I think that people's belief in the theory is based primarily on gut instinct from watching the Unsolved Mystery segment, not hard facts. Like I just mentioned, the only time I've ever seen anyone in law enforcement express skepticism is when Sheriff Umpleby asked Dorothy about the possibility of Bill attacking her, but it sounds like he was just exploring all avenues and may have been satisfied by Dorothy's answer when she rejected that possibility. I think that if the sheriff truly believed that this was nothing more than an elaborate hoax, he either would have been more outspoken about it during his interview, or not wasted any time appearing on the show at all. This is all just an assumption on my part, but I would not be surprised if there was information left out of the segment which provided a better idea about why the authorities believe the harassment was legitimate. I think the misgivings about the Wacker story may simply be based on the fact that truth is sometimes stranger than fiction, and this is a very out-of-the-ordinary case. After all, why would anyone spend the better part of a decade harassing and threatening an elderly couple who, on the surface, seemed to be living ordinary, unremarkable lives and didn't have any known enemies? But of course, since the debate about whether the attacks on the Wackers were real or fabricated is such a huge part of this story, I do have to address this topic on the episode. Anyway, the Unsolved Mystery segment starts off with the Wackers discovering that their house has been ransacked in January of 1985, and Robert Stack mentions that this was the third incident when something like that had happened. But looking at some comments from posters who believe in the hoax theory, I sometimes wonder if they're influenced by certain details in the show's reenactments, which, as you know, are not always 100% accurate. For example, during the reenactment, when the actor playing Bill sees that his house has been ransacked, he says, quote, "That's it, I've had enough, I'm calling the sheriff." During online discussion, some people have expressed suspicion over the fact that Bill waited until his house was vandalized 3 times before he involved the authorities. But the problem is that it's never explicitly stated that Bill did not contact the sheriff's office during the previous 2 incidents. That's just an assumption which has been made because of a line of dialogue from an actor. In actuality, we don't really know anything about the other 2 incidents, or if they were serious enough to involve the police. What we do know is that sometime over the next 6 months, Dorothy underwent heart surgery, and it was during her recuperation, when she was supposedly attacked by an unidentified young man who asked to use her phone. Even though Dorothy was found bound and gagged, and it sounded like she sustained legitimate injuries, I have seen skepticism expressed about her story from people who do not find it believable that she would just allow a complete stranger into her home like that, and then walk into a different room while he made his phone call. Well, you have to remember that the Wackers were from an entirely different generation, and Dorothy had spent her entire life living in a small Ohio town, which I'm sure was not a hotbed of violent crime, so I don't find it unbelievable that she would be trusting enough to allow a man into her home who said his car had broken down. But of course, what is unusual is the fact that no one seems to have any idea who this guy is, even though it seems like there was something very personal about the attacks on the Wackers. On the one hand, since a couple of items were stolen from the house, I could accept the possibility that Dorothy was the random target of someone who wanted to commit a robbery. Perhaps when this guy wrote, "Cheaper, but will do," on the dining room wall in crayon, that was his way of saying that there wasn't as many valuable items in the house as he was hoping, but he was still willing to steal them. But why would this guy then decide to return every single one of these stolen items to the residents months later at different intervals? What would he possibly have to gain by this? Even if the items were not as valuable as he was hoping, he still could have made some money by pawning them. I honestly cannot think of another case where a victim's gun was stolen, but then suddenly returned out of the blue sometime later. Under normal circumstances, I might have been able to classify the attack on Dorothy as an isolated incident, which had no connection to the other harassment, but the fact that these items were returned seems to go against that. But then again, if the whole thing was a personal crime meant to torment the whackers, it's very odd that the perpetrator would have been willing to show his face to Dorothy. I guess the other possibility is that the attacker could have been an outside party who was hired by the mastermind to attack Dorothy and rob the place, and this person subsequently left the area, which is why he's never been identified. In fact, if you believe Bill was responsible for the second attack on Dorothy in 1993, who's to say he didn't hire someone to attack Dorothy the first time? But what would the motive have been? The issue is that there's very little information available about the whackers' lives prior to these attacks, only that Bill served as a private first class in the army during World War II and got married to Dorothy during this time period. I have not read anything to suggest there was any history of abuse or violence during the marriage, so why would Bill just suddenly start orchestrating attacks on his wife when they became senior citizens? And on the other side of the coin, why would the couple decide to orchestrate an elaborate hoax at this stage of their lives? With the Cindy James case, the victim had a mental breakdown and spent some time in an institution, so you could believe she was capable of fabricating attacks against herself, but as far as I can tell, there isn't any known history of mental illness in the Whackers' background. Of course, the Whackers' harassment campaign really started going into overdrive in the months following the attack on Dorothy, as they started hearing weird noises outside their house at night and started receiving threatening notes and phone calls. You'd assume that the authorities would have had access to phone records to figure out where these threatening calls originated from, but we are talking about a small town police department during the 1980s, and if they did manage to trace the calls, they never released that information. It is interesting how even though the Whackers changed their phone number a number of times, these threatening calls kept coming, letting credence to the theory that a family member or someone close to them might have been responsible for this, which is how they managed to keep obtaining the new numbers. The police also believed that the person who wrote the threatening notes took steps to ensure their handwriting would not be recognized. Yet if the Whackers believed that someone from their inner circle might have been a promising suspect, they have never said so publicly. I think another big issue with having only one primary source of information for this case is that there aren't many specific dates and times available for the incidents of harassment. We know that it started sometime in late 1984, and the last documented incidents involving the second attack on Dorothy and the stakeout occurred in October and November of 1993. But it's really not clear just how frequent this harassment was during that 9-year window, as it was apparently quite sporadic, with months sometimes passing by without a single incident before things flared up again. Given that the first attack on Dorothy took place in the summer of 1985, I have no idea why someone felt compelled to attack her again 8 years later, though the key difference is that Dorothy identified an attacker the first time around, but we have no idea who was responsible the second time. It sounds like the injuries from the second attack were a bit more severe than the injuries from the first, so I have no idea what brought on the sudden escalation into violence. During his Unsolved Mysteries interview, Sheriff Umpleby stated that during their investigation, they never found any neighbors or residents from the area who reported seeing anything or could offer useful information. But if you go through that lengthy thread about this case on the Unsolved Mysteries message board, you'll actually find a photo of the Whacker residence on Google Maps, which provides more context about the area in which they lived. It's not exactly in the middle of nowhere, but it is in a rural area outside the Massillon city limits. And while there are other houses on the same road, they are mostly spread apart, So I don't find it too unbelievable that someone could covertly sneak around the Wacker residents and harass them without drawing the attention of any of their neighbors. In fact, what if it was one of the neighbors who was responsible for their harassment? Following the second attack on Dorothy, she and Bill enlisted the help of their daughters and sons-in-law to set up a stakeout outside their home, and naturally, some people have questioned why they would have waited so long to do something like this after being terrorized for 9 years. Well, I think they likely decided to take this next step because things had recently escalated into violence, and given that the Wacker family weren't professional police officers, they may not have been very discreet when they organized their stakeout, so the perpetrator may have caught on to the fact that the house was being watched. Now, I want to be careful here, not to confuse details from the Unsolved Mysteries reenactments with facts, but after Dorothy and Kathy hear a loud thumping outside the house, they find a note on the front porch, which has been wrapped around a rock. It's never explicitly stated during the segment that a rock was used, but if that detail in the reenactment is accurate, then this would explain how the note wound up on the front porch without anybody from the family seeing anything, as the perpetrator may have thrown the rock from a concealed place before taking off. The Unsolved Mysteries segment aired in May of 1994, about 6 months after this incident took place, so I'd really be curious to know when exactly the decision was made to take this case to the show. This was definitely a lot different than your typical true crime story on Unsolved Mysteries, since it did not involve a death or a missing person, but considering that it did not get any mainstream publicity, it really must have captured the show's attention when they decided to profile it. Believers in the hoax theory have speculated that perhaps the Wackers' motive for staging the whole thing was because they were bored, elderly retirees who wanted attention, but the problem is that the harassment and attacks continued on for nearly a decade before they even received any of this attention. Back when this all started in 1984, Unsolved Mysteries was not even a thing yet, and there's no way the Wackers could have foreseen their story receiving exposure on national television. I get the impression that the Wackers' decision to put their story out there may have been born out of the hope that nationwide attention might finally motivate the responsible person or persons to finally stop, leave them alone, and give them some peace. I can't say with 100% certainty that's what happened, but if there was no further harassment of Bill and Dorothy until they passed away years later, then their strategy may have actually worked. I really do not believe the hoax theory adds up, but before I start talking about potential suspects, I want to take a few moments to talk about another unsolved case which I briefly mentioned during the intro, as it involves an elderly woman who was harassed and tormented for months by an unknown party before she wound up dead under suspicious circumstances. I recently saw a poster under the username The Bones of Autumn start a thread about this case at the Unresolved Mysteries subreddit, and if there was more information available, it would probably be worthy of its own podcast episode. But I wanted to discuss it here because you can draw some interesting parallels with the Wacker case. The victim in this story is 87-year-old Sigrid Barginde, a retired bookkeeper who lives alone in a modest brick house on the south side of Chicago. Sigrid was nearly deaf and had very poor eyesight, requiring thick glasses in order to see 10 inches in front of her. In April of 1981, Sigrid phoned up the Chicago Police Department to describe a terrifying incident. She told them she had fallen asleep on the couch while watching TV, but when she woke up, she saw what she described as three shadowy figures moving around her living room. When Sigrid screamed, these intruders covered her with a sheet before hitting her in the head and face. They then put her inside a closet, and Sigrid said she could hear faint sounds of the intruders searching through her home, but once it became quiet again, she finally exited and called for help. While the police couldn't find any signs of forced entry at Sigrid's residence, she had a head injury and a black eye, and the sheet which had been used to cover her head was stained with blood. Oddly, Sigrid went to a neighbor's residence to call the police, because when she attempted to make the call from her own phone, she said that no one could hear her. Well, when police took Sigrid's phone in for repairs, they discover that pieces of the voice transmitter had been ripped out of the receiver. After the phone was fixed, the receiver was screwed back on very tightly before it was returned to Sigrid, but 1 week later, she called the police again from her neighbor's phone to complain about her own telephone having been tampered with. Sure enough, when police checked it out, they discovered that pieces of the voice transmitter had been removed from the receiver again. This time around, after the repairs were made, the receiver was glued shut, but 1 week after the phone was returned, Sigrid contacted the police yet again to complain about her phone not working, and when they arrived at the residence to check it out, they discovered that the receiver and cord had been pulled out. The authorities were not sure what to make of the whole situation, because even though there was no real reason to believe that Sigrid was staging the whole thing, the only access point to her residence appeared to be a bedroom window, which opened around 8 to 10 inches and seemed too small for an intruder who was older than a kid. Regardless, the locks on Sigrid's house were changed, and the police decided to provide additional surveillance as they would frequently drive by the residence while their neighbors cut down some weeds to ensure that the residence was more visible to them. On June the 18th, while making a trip to the bank, Sigrid claimed she was the victim of an attempted mugging by multiple men who attempted to steal her purse. Sigrid managed to hold on to it before she fled to a neighbor's house and called the police. According to her neighbors, Sigrid seemed absolutely terrified by her constant ordeal and would often break out into tears while talking about it, stating, quote, "They're going to get me, I know it." A social worker who regularly checked in on Sigrid went so far as to suggest that she move elsewhere, but Sigrid was reluctant to do so, believing that she would be unable to sell her property if she told the buyer that she was being victimized by burglaries. The repairman who fixed Sigrid's phone had since become friends with her, so he decided to drop by Sigrid's house on June the 26th in order to check in on her. When no one answered the door, he decided to contact the police, who promptly arrived and entered the residence. They soon found Sigrid's dead body lying face down on her bed, and her hands were tied with a tan scarf. There were no signs of forced entry, and once again, her phone's receiver and cord had been ripped out, and a child's chair, which was normally kept in the bedroom, was found in the hallway with strips of sheets tied around it. When Sigrid's body was examined by Dr. Wayne Carver of the Cook County Medical Examiner's Office, he determined that her official cause of death was a heart attack. According to Dr. Carver, quote, "In order to classify the case as a homicide, there would have to be evidence that another person's actions led to her death. We have found no such evidence in this case. We don't know what spurred it. It's possible that it came as a result of a shock, but there is no way to verify it one way or another," end quote. So technically, Sigrid's death would have to be attributed to natural causes, and the case was officially closed on July the 30th. Sigrid's sister, Ingveldt Berginde Evans, made the trip from Colorado to Chicago and wound up getting into a dispute with the police when they refused to release their records about the case to her. When Ingveldt's daughter entered Sigrid's residence to begin cleaning and boxing things up, she was shocked to discover a large amount of blood on Sigrid's bed, headboard, and a pillow, and wound up taking photographs of the scene. This prompted Sigrid's family to hire a private investigator to look into her case, and a Cook County probate judge would issue a court order demanding that the police turn over all the records to them. Unfortunately, this is pretty much where this story ends, as I cannot find any media coverage of this case at all after September of 1981. So I can only assume that the family's investigation into Sigrid's death went nowhere, but from what little information we have, this is a truly terrifying and frustrating story. The idea that the Chicago PD decided to close this case because Sigrid's official cause of death was a heart attack just makes me want to tear my hair out. Even if that is technically what happened, if this heart attack was the result of an intruder breaking into her home and tying her up, then that person is still complicit in her death. Believe it or not, Dr. Carver did say that it was technically possible for Sigrid to have tied her own hands up, but how likely is that for an 87-year-old woman? It's also pretty mind-boggling to think that Sigrid's niece apparently photographed blood on the bed where Sigrid's body was found 2 months after her death. Was that blood actually there the whole time and just ignored by the police? It's also unsettling to see that the police were initially skeptical about Sigrid's account of the violent attack against her, even though she had a head injury and a black eye. I guess in a way, I can understand the police's skepticism, since there were no signs of forced entry, but herein lies a terrifying possibility. What if there was an intruder who secretly entered her house and never left? We're talking about a woman who was practically deaf and had such poor eyesight she could only see 10 feet in front of her, so after the first incident, this attacker could have just decided to hide in an attic or a crawl space or something, and was able to remain there undetected. Every time Sigrid's phone was repaired, this person decided to emerge from their hiding spot in order to tamper with it, because they got off on toying with her. This person then might have decided to sneak up on Sigrid and tie her up, but did not expect her to succumb to a fatal heart attack. In essence, they may have literally scared her to death. While this scenario might sound a bit far-fetched, it's actually not unprecedented. For an example, look up the story of Theodore Edward Conies, aka the Denver Spider-Man, who somehow managed to live inside the attic at the home of an elderly Denver couple named Philip and Helen Peters for 9 consecutive months before he was caught. In fact, Conies wound up murdering Mr. Peters inside the kitchen while his wife was recovering in the hospital, which left the authorities completely baffled because all of the house's doors and windows were locked. But that was because Coney snuck back into the attic undetected, and when Mrs. Peters returned home from the hospital, she was completely unaware that her husband's killer was still occupying the house with her. While I'm not saying this is exactly what happened in Sigrid Barginda's case, because let's not forget that during the initial attack on her, she reported seeing 3 shadowy figures inside her house. All signs seem to point to it being an attempted robbery, though it's unclear if anything was actually stolen. But someone could have used that as the jumping-off point to senselessly torment an elderly woman for the next 2 months. There's really not enough information to form a concrete theory in this case, but I thought it was important to tie Sigrid's story to the Wacker case because it just demonstrates that there are people out there who get off on tormenting others for no logical reason. I always wonder how people would look at this case today if Bill and or Dorothy had suffered the same fate as Sigrid and wound up dead because of the harassment they faced. While there are definitely documented cases of people staging fake attacks on themselves, the issue with believing this is what happened with Bill, Dorothy, and Sigrid is that they were all senior citizens. Orchestrating fake harassment campaigns and inflicting injuries on yourself is a lot of work, particularly when you're an advanced age. So the idea of Bill and Dorothy doing this while in their 60s and 70s and somehow managing to keep up the ruse for a decade without getting caught just does not ring true for me. I know there has been suspicion about the fact that the Wackers refused to move out of their house, even though they seemed to believe that the person behind the harassment was attempting to drive them away. Well, why should they have to append their entire lives over this? Hell, even Sigrid was given the suggestion to move, even though she was 87 years old and could barely hear or see. Moving requires a lot of work, and when you're a senior citizen who has settled into a comfortable retirement in a home you like, having to relocate is a difficult ordeal. In Bill's own words, "Why should we be forced out by a kook?" However, this all leads to the biggest unanswered question. What kind of kook would have had a motive to harass the Wackers for such a long period of time? One alternate theory which has been pushed forward is that the responsible party was not after the Wackers personally, and instead had their eye on their house or the property they lived on, but it does seem like overkill to relentlessly keep this up for so many years over a real estate dispute. It just seems like the whole thing had to be personal, but the perpetrator's reasons for it may have only made sense in their own mind. Of course, the most prominent theory which has been pushed around is that the perpetrator either had to be a family member or someone with a close personal connection to the Wackers. Part of me wonders if the Wackers did find out who was responsible for the harassment sometime after the Unsolved Mysteries segment originally aired, but decided to keep their identity a secret from the public for privacy reasons. Whatever the case, given that the principals have since passed away, we'll probably never know the full truth about what happened, and this may be destined to remain one of the most bizarre unsolved mysteries of all time. I don't think the Wacker case is being actively investigated anymore, but if by chance you happen to have any information about the death of Sigrid Barginde, please contact the appropriate authorities. But if you just have your own thoughts about what happened, feel free to leave me a comment or send me an email to robin.warder@icloud.com. That's robin.warder@icloud.com. Now, the reminder that The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so please visit patreon.com/thetrailwentcold to learn how you can support our podcast and become eligible for some pretty neat rewards. We produced a bunch of exclusive bonus episodes for our patrons in tiers 2 and 3, and this past month, I released an episode about the 1982 disappearance of Sherry Ierley, which was featured on a rather infamous segment of Unsolved Mysteries, where a psychic pointed the finger at a potential suspect who may have been innocent. And for our patrons in tier 3, I've also recorded another new audio commentary track, which can be played over a classic episode of Unsolved Mysteries. I'd also like to give a shout out to our most recent listeners who have signed up with us on Patreon this week, and they are Julio F. and Jamie M. Thank you so much for your support. And before we bring this episode to a close, I'd like to play a promo for the all-new season of the true crime podcast, Scene of the Crime.
In season 1 of Scene of the Crime, we explored the tragic 2017 double murder of Abigail Williams and Liberty German in Delphi, Indiana. Now, season 2 is upon us, and we are digging into another double murder. But this time around, the victims and circumstances couldn't be more different. Roger Atkison and Rose Burkert were brutally murdered in their hotel room at the Amana Holiday Inn in Williamsburg, Iowa in September of 1980, and a killer wielding a heavy-bladed weapon in room 260, most likely a hatchet, would ensure that Roger and Rose didn't leave the hotel alive. Join us starting October 14th of 2020 as we kick off Season 2 of Scene of the Crime. Search for and subscribe to Scene of the Crime right now so you don't miss a single moment.
In addition, I also wanted to provide another reminder that for the past several months, I have been hosting live streaming sessions on a platform called Get Vocal. Every Thursday night from 7 until 8 p.m. Eastern Time, I host what is essentially an after show for each week's podcast episode, where I have an interactive discussion about the featured case from said episode and answer questions and address comments from listeners. I always include a link to these sessions in our show notes of every episode, so be sure to check there for more information, or visit getvocal.com. That's GETVOKL.com. I also just wanted to give another shout-out to my supporters at the Unresolved Mysteries subreddit and the Unsolved Mysteries message board at the Sitcoms Online forum, where if you feel like delving into a deep rabbit hole, contains a very lengthy discussion about the Wacker case. I need to provide a big thanks to McGill Foote, who edits and assembles this podcast together for me, and Vince Nitro, who composes the eerie music you hear on every episode. And of course, as you probably heard, we've been playing a special Halloween-themed version of the Trail Went Cold theme this month. If you haven't already, you can like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or leave us a rating or review on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, or Spotify. So have yourself a good week and a happy Halloween, and join us next Wednesday for another brand new episode of The Trail Went Cold.